you so much. Thank you guys for having me here tonight. I'm nervous, and I don't think this ever gets easier. At least it won't for me. I hate being in front of people. I especially hate being honest in front of people about the things that I did and what my life was like before I came into this program, and still sometimes what my life is like today when I get out of touch with this program. So I'm going to do my best to tell you my story as it actually happened and what I've experienced since I've come into this program, which has truly been a miracle for me, and that I can honestly say. So thank you, Billy, for asking me. My name is Caitlin. I'm an alcoholic, and my sobriety date is March 30th of 2011. I have a sponsor. I have a home group that I went to this morning. It's Awakenings in Richmond. We are also a speaker meeting, so 9:30, if you're out in the area, come and join us. It is fabulous. And I heard a great friend speak there this morning, so I'm fired up for AA today. And happy Mother's Day to all the mothers. I got to speak to my mom this morning, and I didn't get to see her tonight because she understands my commitment to AA and showing up when I make a commitment, and she supports that, and I am so blessed in my life to have family that supports what's important to me, and they know how important AA is to me. So sponsor, home group, sobriety date, and I'll start telling you what it was like. I was not born into an alcoholic family. I was not exposed to alcohol at a young age. I didn't have any of the excuses that I wanted to have on why I drank or why I thought the way that I did. I was uncomfortable from a really early age, and I didn't fit in, and I hear that a lot from people, and that's why I know, one of the reasons that I know that AA is a good place for me, because I hear when you guys share with me, I hear my story, I hear my feelings, I hear my childhood and my adolescence and my young adulthood. I hear all of that when you guys speak, and it doesn't matter what your actual specific experiences were. I felt the same way. I knew that alcohol was bad. I wasn't exposed to alcohol, but I had my dad's side of the family liked alcohol, and my mom liked to let me know that they liked alcohol. And she also liked to tell me that if I were to drink, then I would be an alcoholic. That was one of the two things that I knew for certain. The other one is that I needed to start drinking Diet Coke when my friends were drinking regular soda, or else I would become fat. Like, those were the absolutes in my life when I was a child. So, you know, I had an understanding of what would happen to me if I drank. I would become like my grandfather or my uncle, who really enjoyed alcohol and weren't very nice people when they were drinking. So that was the general idea that I was given. And, you know, I don't have one of those stories where I started drinking when I was 8. I don't have one of those I saw the light when I started drinking stories. Alcohol came into my life. Like, I feel like it came into a lot of my friends' lives. It was like laying around my friend's dad's basement. I tried to sip a beer. I hated it. It wasn't magic for me. I didn't have that experience. But it crept into my life. It became a large part of my life, I feel like, very quickly. Once I realized what it could do for me, once I could get past the taste or how much I had to drink or what I preferred, like, that never really came into play. When I realized the feeling that it gave me, the effect that it had on me, and when I realized that I wasn't thinking about myself anymore as much as I was so aware when I was sober of how I presented and how I looked and how I sounded, and what I was doing to impress the people that I needed to impress, when I could stop thinking about that and when I could focus on something else, which ended up being alcohol, that was when I realized that that was what I needed in my life, and I couldn't get enough of it once I realized that. So I kind of sailed through, like, middle school and high school, and when I say I sailed, I did enough to get by. I didn't like to work hard, but I liked to look good, which was a difficult thing to balance because I didn't like to, you know, I was never really great at anything. I was never the best at anything, but I was always really involved because I wanted to impress my parents, or I wanted to impress my friends, or I wanted to impress a boy. So I would always be busy, but I was just never focused on any one thing. And so I did just enough to be involved to have one college accept me when I was in high school. And at this point, I can't specifically tell you what my drinking looked like, and that's a theme, because I was a blackout drinker. My drinking career lasted for about like 10 to 12 years, and that's an estimate, and there's a lot of gray area in there. So when I tell you that I'm trying to tell my story to the best of my ability, I'm honestly trying to tell you the honest truth. So my drinking was present when I was in high school. It hadn't consumed me yet, and it hadn't taken a hold, and so I was able to skirt by. And I got accepted into a college, one college. I applied to one college, no more. But that was what I was supposed to do, and I got accepted there, and I got a scholarship, and this college happened to be 6 hours away from Richmond, where I'd grown up. It was in Southwest Virginia, the furthest college in the state that I could get away with without going out of state. And nobody in my high school that I knew was going there. Nobody that I knew went there. So in my mind, what I had always wanted, because my friends weren't good enough, my family wasn't good enough, my home wasn't good enough, Midlothian and Richmond weren't good enough, what I always wanted to do, I just wanted to start over. Because that popular group that I wasn't accepted into in high school, I had a pretty good chance of getting accepted into it in this place where nobody knew me. And, you know, that boy that didn't like me in 11th grade, the boys would like me if they didn't know if I could just be a new person. That's what I really wanted to be. And there was no reason behind that. My family was wonderful. My friends were wonderful. My home was wonderful. I just needed something different. I needed something more. I always needed something more than what I had. And so I went 6 hours away from home and kind of just didn't look back. I created this identity, and this is, I was never really clear or honest about this identity that I created at school, and it's actually a little bit insane. Once I realized what I was doing when I got down to this college. But I created this whole alternate reality when I went down to school. And I really wanted attention from people. And that's also something that you're going to hear a lot from me tonight. I wanted attention. And it didn't matter if it was positive attention. It didn't matter if it was negative attention. I just wanted you to want to know more about me. I wanted you to like me. Sometimes I wanted you to feel sorry for me, if that worked. And so I created this reality that I had grown up in poverty. I was homeless for like 10 years. My parents like pulled themselves up by the bootstraps. It was insane and all made up. Like, I grew up in the suburbs of Richmond. I went to public schools. Like, none of this was true, but I made up this whole sob story, wrote papers about it. My professors knew. It was insane. So that was my personality when I went down to Emory and Henry. And I guess what I had made up were my excuses for how I could drink or why I could drink. And when I went down there, when I created this new reality for myself, I drank like I had been wanting to drink, like I hadn't realized that I had been wanting to drink. And people down in Southwest Virginia really liked the way that I drank. I made friends quickly. I was really, really good at drinking games. I was always okay with drinking. You know, so if there's an exam the next day, let's go drinking. If you've got class at 8 o'clock in the morning, I'll get you back to your dorm by 4. Like, you've got 3 hours there sleep. I could always find an excuse and a reason to justify somebody else drinking like I did, and I was extremely good at getting people to do that. The problem was is that other people, even though they would like participate with me in sometimes, they were still able to get their stuff done. They were still able to live life. And I couldn't understand how they could compartmentalize the drinking from the school, the drinking from the responsibilities, the drinking from the relationships, because for me, the drinking was everything. The drinking came into my relationships. It prevented me from going to school because it was much more appealing than classes. Like, college to me was not an opportunity to learn. It was an opportunity to party, and that's what I did. So class fell by the wayside. Relationships were falling by the wayside. My family is like an afterthought. I'm barely in touch with them. The school is extremely plugged into what you're doing down there because it's a small 1,200-person school. You know, you're not blending in anywhere, especially not when you drink like me. And so my parents are getting these phone calls, and they're, like, coming down to see me, and I'm locking myself in my dorm room, and I'm not answering their calls. And, you know, they're concerned. I'm an only child. They're paying for part of my tuition at this private school, and professors are calling and deans are calling, and you know, it's not going well for me. But I don't know that I was good at, like, explaining myself or manipulating. I actually know that I was terrible at it, but my parents were so, they wanted to believe me so bad, the lies that I was giving them, that it worked for a certain amount of time, you know. And those lies only lasted until the proof was in the pudding, you know, and my grades came in. And I was talking to Michelle and TJ on the way up. I've been, even in sobriety, I've been too scared to look at my transcripts from Emory and Henry because it's, I don't want to know the reality of it. I don't want to know how bad it was because it was bad. So I told people for many, many years that I decided that college wasn't for me, that after a year and a half of, you know, trying it, that I was bowing out gracefully and that I was going to make it in the real world. And the reality was I got kicked out. I was asked to leave Emory and Henry. I was living on campus for like a year, not going to classes, and basically being a terrible influence on those around me that were trying to do the right thing. So it was like, you got to go. And so that was fine because it gave me a chance to prove my parents wrong. It gave me a chance to prove to them that the right path for everyone is not high school, college, job, marriage, family. I'm going to be a trailblazer. I'm going to make it on my own. And what that looked like for me was moving into my parents' house in a car that they were paying for and getting a job at a tanning salon as a manager there. And that was my career, and that's how I was going to make it. So the drinking has progressed, obviously. There are some consequences in my life from it that I can explain away, not due to drinking. Like, I painted this picture in my head that I really honestly believe that I'm just trying this different path in life. And the drinking is, I mean, it's there. It's always there. So just take that as a given through the rest of my story, because I'm living basically to drink. And my means are not enough to support my drinking. I think at that time it was like $9 an hour was not enough to support my drinking. And so the way that my mind works is that I need to do something more so that I can get what I want. And that something more isn't like walking dogs or like watching babies at night when I get off of work. That something more is I'm smarter than my employer, and so I'm going to start stealing from you. Because that's the easiest way, that's the quickest way, and you'll never find out about it because I'm smarter than you. And so that's what I did. I lied, I stole, I cheated. You know, my life at 19 years old is falling apart. I don't think there's anybody that could say, like, this girl looks like she's got her stuff together. It's falling apart. And I'm just making it. I'm just making it and drinking and stealing, and I don't see any problem with it until I start to get caught. And then there's an issue because I'm facing some consequences that my family didn't think that I'd ever have to face. They didn't know how to deal with it. I didn't know how to deal with it because I'd been saved so many times. I'd been pulled out of the situations that I had gotten myself in, that when I was confronted with, like, people that weren't really willing to save me. Like, the police didn't care that I grew up in a good neighborhood and that I had a good family. And, you know, I went to church and stuff like that. The police didn't care about that. What they cared about was that I was stealing a significant amount of money. Ended up stealing a woman's engagement ring that came into the tanning salon, which was over $10,000. And so I got charged with grand larceny at 19 years old. And I got exposed for the first time to Alcoholics Anonymous in treatment. So what that looks like is my charge has nothing to do with drinking. It really has nothing to do with any sort of other substances at all. It has to do with my behavior. But I'm introduced to a lawyer who hears my sob story when I come into his office because my parents have paid for a lawyer. He hears my sob story about my drinking and about my charge, and he tells me, you need to check yourself into a 28-day inpatient rehab, and we can get these charges reduced for you. And what I heard was, I'm going to get out of this. Like, there's a chance. And so I didn't think, why is this man telling me to check into an inpatient rehab when my charges are stealing? He knows nothing about my drinking. He knows nothing about my social life, but he's telling me to check into an inpatient rehab. And so I think that we're on the same page here and that he's just trying to get me out of trouble. And so I go for 28 days to this rehab, and I hear what I need to hear, and I soak it all in, not because I want to change, not because I want to get sober, but because I want to learn what I need to say to explain why I'm not like these people that are in this 28-day rehab with me. Why at 19 years old, I'm not an alcoholic because I haven't had the DUIs. I haven't lost a house. I haven't lost a car. I haven't lost relationships. And a lot of that is because I didn't have those things to lose at that time, you know? And the fact that I didn't have a DUI is because I hadn't gotten caught. Like, these things don't enter my mind at this point. And so I take in just enough to be able to tell you why you're an alcoholic and why you're an addict, but to explain to you why I am not. And I get out of rehab after 28 days, and I drink the next day. I had no intention of being sober. My charges were reduced to a misdemeanor, and I just continued on my merry way. But the thing was, the seed had been planted in my head. That was the first time, that was my first exposure to a 12-step program of recovery. I didn't hear anything that I needed to hear at that time, but I did carry the things with me that, you know, kind of created the red flags later in life. And so all of those not yets that I had in treatment became my reality. So the DUIs that I didn't have, I did a good job of making up for that, not having them earlier in life. I collected a few of them later. And, you know, I lost the car. I lost a few cars. I went through a crazy amount of money in 7 years. I spent my entire inheritance from my grandfather. I moved in with my parents multiple times, and then they kicked me out, and I moved out on my own, and I would end up with them again. Like, this was my life. This was my cycle. I had gotten into the restaurant industry, which allowed me to blend in for a little while and kind of not let me see what I was doing and my behavior. That was not normal, but it was in that environment. And so I was able to slide under the radar for quite a bit of time. And so I got in my first DUI, and at that time that was in 2003, and they just weren't that big of a deal. I've heard people talk about DUIs in the 80s and 90s, and it was a bigger deal than that. So they tried to give me some consequences, like a restricted license, which means nothing to me. And they had told me to go to AA meetings. So I came because I thought that I had to, because I had to get this sheet signed. But then I saw the people that were signing the sheet, and it was just you guys. Like, it was, I figured out that my friends could be you guys on paper. And so that was my experience with AA at that point in 2003. And I wasn't ready to hear anything. I wasn't ready to get sober. I had so many reasons why I was not an alcoholic that nothing would have sunk in at that point. And so that first DUI was kind of a blip on the radar, and I had gotten through hospitality, I had gotten this dream job at the time, this dream job that I didn't deserve, that I wasn't qualified for. I landed it really on a fluke, and that was that became the reason that I was not an alcoholic for the next 5 years. I drank like I wanted to. I behaved like I wanted to. I would pull other people in with me. I would create these allies at my job that were my drinking buddies and the people that I would go to the bar with, but they were really the people that I used to protect me at work. Like, if somebody tried to call me out on my behavior, on how I was drinking, it was, well, so-and-so was with me last night, and they were doing the same thing, and blah, blah, blah. So I had all these protective factors with me, like, in all areas of my life that, like, they slowly start to slip away as I continue doing what I'm doing. And I was just, I destroyed people's lives is what I did. I absolutely destroyed them. And at the end of that 5 years, I don't know how I made it that long. I don't know how I pulled through or how other people pulled me through that. But it got to a point that there was no denying what was going on with me. And I was not doing my job, and I was not performing. And it was obvious to the people that I was supervising that I was not doing what I needed to be doing. And so my boss sat me down, and this was probably about the fourth or fifth conversation he had had with me in like a two-month span. He sat me down, and he had a conversation with me that is a mirror image of the conversation in two employers. He sat me down and he said, "We will send you to treatment. We will do whatever you need to do to fix this, to treat this, take some time. We will do whatever it takes. But if you continue like you are now without going to treatment, without taking some time, you can't continue working with us, but you have that choice. I'm giving you that choice." And I didn't even have to think about it. I didn't even have to stop and think about it. "I don't need treatment. I know what you're trying to say. Thanks, but no thanks. I'll turn in my resignation letter today." And just that quickly, my dream job goes. A job that was the reason that I was not an alcoholic. And I didn't have a reason to not be an alcoholic anymore after that. And so it was like just a slingshot. As soon as I left that place, I burrowed into my one-bedroom, I lived alone apartment. I lived for the next year in a blackout. Like, my apartment was disgusting. I won't even get into what my living conditions were at that time. But I just couldn't function. I wouldn't answer my door. I didn't open my mail. I was telling them on the way up, I didn't know how to pay bills when I got sober because I just let them pile up in my mailbox and then would throw them out when I got full. I couldn't do life anymore. I couldn't do life without alcohol. And, you know, I would try to be social. I would still meet up with friends at the bar, and I would black out within the first hour. And I just couldn't do it anymore. I just couldn't be around people, and I would have to go back and hold myself up in my apartment and drink like I wanted to drink because I just, you know, I wasn't tempering my drinking with them, but I also wasn't drinking like I wanted to drink, which was just to oblivion and to pass out and forget about it all. And I was practicing some dangerous behavior at the time. A lot of it included driving drunk and in blackouts. I would drive. I drove up 95 one morning, not really with any destination. I think I was trying to go to work. I was trying to go to work because I had found, like, these jobs in between that would hire me, and then I just wouldn't show up. And this was one of those mornings. I was driving on 95 to get to work, and I just kept on going past the exit that I was supposed to be going down. I picked up some crabs on the side of the road, some live crabs, and went into a hotel room like 45 minutes away from Richmond and holed up for 2 days. Yeah, crabs. had beer and crabs and wouldn't answer my phone and lost that job and like went right back into the cycle. Like, these are the insane things that I did. And so I had these people that I would meet up with every now and then. And so I was at this bar one night trying to be social, and I told this guy that I was going to go home and take a nap and come pick him back up because I was always driving people because I was the responsible drunk driver or something. And so I told him I was going to go home, take a nap, and then come back and pick him back up because I had to be at work the next morning, so I needed some shut-eye. And so I left the bar and I guess parked my car and fell asleep and was woken up by a VCU police officer knocking on my window and asking me to pull over. And I didn't understand, and I rolled down my window and I told him, you know, I was trying to explain to him I'm already pulled over, like I just needed to shut my eyes for a little bit before I go pick my friends up at the bar, and he let me know that I wasn't pulled over, that I was in the middle of Marshall Street downtown, passed out in my car, and he was going to need to talk to me for a little bit. And so that was my second DUI, 7 years later from my first, and he gave me the opportunity to call my roommate at the time, because I had acquired a roommate for the course of this time. I don't know. That year was crazy. So I called my roommate and was trying to convince him the cop was going to let him come pick me up. And the cop grabbed the phone for me to try to explain to him, because I wasn't doing a very good job on my own, to try to explain to him what was going on. And I bit him, the cop, as he's trying to explain to my roommate the situation. And, you know, he told my roommate, I'm going to have to let you go. She just bit me. And I tried to explain to him that it was a love bite. And he wasn't having it. So off to Richmond Jail I go. VCU cops are real cops. I found that out that night. And, you know, I spent the night in jail, and I got out the next morning, and I went to Village Cafe on the corner with with my roommate, actually, laughing about the story and taking shots at 10 o'clock in the morning. Didn't even faze me. So they let me out on bail, and that was a mistake, because I was still doing what I was doing, and about a month later, I was driving home from this other job that had hired me, and I was blacked out, completely blacked out this night, and I was pulled over when I got off of work, and was arrested, and woke up in jail. A few days later, I don't remember the first few days, but a few days later, woke up in jail, had a meeting with a magistrate where I thought I was getting out. I thought I was meeting with him, and he was going to tell me what my bond was, and then I was going home, because that's what happened. You know, I got arrested. I spent the night in jail. I got out of it. Mom and Dad came and saved me, and, you know, that was those were my consequences, a night in jail, you know, which isn't bad. So he had different plans for me. He let me know that I was going to be there for a while, that I wasn't getting bond because I was already out on bond for my second DUI that I had just gotten a month prior. So at that point, I can't be trusted, and I'm shocked. I don't understand why he doesn't see the person that I am, and why are they holding me. So I go back to my cell, and I've got a meeting with my lawyer later, and I find the papers in my cell of what I was charged with. And for third DUI in Virginia, and I still can't tell you the verbiage. At some point I can look it up, but there's something about manslaughter in the charges of third DUI in Virginia, which is a felony. And that was all my paperwork before I had met with my lawyer and before I understood what had happened. And because I was in a blackout when I got arrested, I didn't know. There were a few hours in there where I didn't know. I thought that I had killed somebody, I didn't. It turns out that that's just the verbiage of the charge. But I can tell you, looking back on it, I didn't realize it at the time, but how painful it is to think about that was a possibility. That was a very real possibility that I had killed somebody that night and had no idea. So that was how I drank, and that was how I thought, even when I was caught for my drinking, is that I should be able to get out of this. Like, I don't deserve this. I if you had the life that I had, then you would drink like I drank. And you know, the reality is my life was not that bad. I was just an alcoholic. I was a hopeless, hopeless alcoholic. And it had just gotten to a point where I couldn't go on any further, and I couldn't stop myself. The knowledge that I had and the experience that I had with AA, I couldn't get myself to call you guys. I couldn't get myself to call my family to say I need help. Like, I was that arrogant that I was just willing to die before asking for help. And that's been a huge issue for me in this program, is humbling myself and asking for help. And God's worked in some pretty amazing ways to make sure that I had to do that since I got sober. So I didn't get out of jail the next day. I was actually there for 10 months. I was blessed to be in a jail that had a recovery program that you could opt in for. And so we had meetings from like 7 o'clock in the morning until 7 o'clock at night, not just AA meetings and NA meetings, but like anger management and stuff like that, exercise. I was in a structured environment for 10 months, which was, for me, that's a God thing. Because I think if I had been just in a day room watching Maury Povich for 10 months, I would have gotten out and done exactly what I was doing before. And so that for me was God intervening and saying, like, look, let me introduce you to a new way of life, and let me let you learn it where you don't have access to alcohol, to other people that can encourage you to drink alcohol or co-sign for you and your behavior. And so for 10 months, I got thirsty. I got really thirsty, not for alcohol, for AA. The speakers that came behind those walls, I hung on to every word. And they were, in my outside life, like in my real life, they were people that I would never give the time of day to, never be able to relate to, is what it was. It was, we called them the Real Housewives of Williamsburg. And they would come in, they were like these little old ladies that would talk about how when their husbands were at work, they would keep these bottles of wine like underneath the bathroom cabinet, and they would sneak these swigs, and like, that was not my life at all. Like, that was not how I drank. But when they talked about, you know, the hopelessness and the guilt and the shame and the embarrassment and all those things that I could definitely relate to, I identified in immediately. And I lived for those meetings. They only came every Saturday morning. And I lived for those AA meetings. And I would, like, stand up for them, too. Like, other inmates would start talking about, like, how they don't understand and blah, blah, blah. I was like, they do understand. I got really, really defensive for them. So anyway, I was thirsty for AA, and I was trying to get it any way that I could. I asked if one of the women could sponsor me while I was in there, and she said that it wouldn't really work like that, but she could do the best that she could. And so I kept this notebook that I would show her every time she came in for a meeting, and it had all 12 steps in it that I had done, written out from my worksheets, like, here you go, I've completed my 12 steps. And I was really excited to get out because I was ready to go in AA. And so I had a really good foundation as far as the willingness when I got out of jail. And I was ready to change. And that's really what was missing in my life, was that willingness and openness to a new way of life. And so when I got out of jail, they told me you need to go to a meeting the day that you get out. And so I'm living with my parents on the condition that I do something productive. They didn't tell me that I needed to be sober. They've been in their own 12-step program since I was 20, which should tell you how long it's been that other people knew that I had a problem, and I didn't know. So they knew enough to detach with love, but they were there for me again. And this time I really wanted to make it worth their while. And so I was staying with them. I didn't have a license. I actually didn't have a license for the first 3 years that I was in this program. And I got to a meeting that night. They drove me. And it was a meeting that was 5 minutes away from my house. And I told my whole story that night. They got to hear it all. And I told them that I had just been in jail for 10 months and that I wanted to stay sober and that I didn't have a license and that I was living with my parents and I didn't know what I wanted to do with my life. And this is how I drank. And, like, can somebody please help me? And you know, that became my home group because they tolerated me for, like, the first 2 years that I was like that. But then I also got numbers of women in that program that, or in that meeting, that told me that my parents shouldn't be driving me to meetings. that was the point of AA, is that if I needed to get to a meeting, here are the numbers in this book that you need to call if you need to get to a meeting. And they were numbers of women that picking up that phone and talking to a human on the other end was really difficult for me. Picking up that phone and asking for help was really difficult for me. And I can tell you, like, the first 3 months, my parents were driving me to meetings. Like, I heard what the lady said. Like, they're not supposed to help you. We're supposed to help you. But I couldn't bring myself to do that, to ask strangers to help me. And so I was slow to jump in the middle. I was, like, on the outskirts. I was getting to meetings at 7 o'clock if they started at 7, and I was leaving at 8:01 when my ride was out the door. I wasn't really getting to know people at any sort of personal level, but I did find a sponsor. We actually got, like, somebody, like, match-made us. It was weird. She was looking for a sponsee, and I was looking for a sponsor, and so she kind of, like, hooked us up. And it worked out perfectly for me because I only needed to call her if there was, like, you know, if there's an emergency, you can call me anytime. Otherwise, we'll just meet once a week and we'll go through the book. And that was all right with me. That sounded I'll call you if there's an emergency, which I never called her. And we met once a week and we went through the book. And it was like a crash course in AA for me. You know, it was exactly what I could handle at the time. What happened was I stuck around. And I was going to enough meetings because I didn't have a job. I was a felon, and I was struggling to find a job. And I wasn't in school yet, and so I probably went to, like, 180 meetings in 90 days, and that was great for me. I wasn't getting to know anyone, but I was hearing what I needed to hear. And I wasn't speaking. I wasn't sharing. I wasn't giving to the meetings I was taking. In the beginning, but I kept on coming back, and the fellowship aspect of AA, you know, it started in my home group. We were a really small group, and we would meet before the meeting just to, like, chat and talk about our weeks, and I had taken the coffee maker position at my home group, which I really valued because I felt needed and wanted, and the meeting couldn't go on without coffee, so I was the most important person, is what somebody told me, and that was really appealing. So I was a coffee maker for, like, 2 years at that home group, and I would get there early, and I would get to talk to people. And, you know, alcohol acted as a social lubricant for me. You know, that was the way that I talked to people. That was the way that I related to people. And so it took me a long time in this program to be able to carry on a conversation. It's still difficult for me to reach out to newcomers and to say welcome and to look them in the eye and start a conversation because it's just, I don't think I'm introverted. It's just really uncomfortable for me. That fear of people creeps up. And that's okay, and I can be honest about that today. But the fellowship started coming into my life, and I started to realize how important it was in my recovery because sobriety for me is not just meetings, and it's not just meeting with my sponsor or meeting with sponsees or going to my district meeting once a month. Sobriety for me is like alcohol was for me. You know, it's all-encompassing. Sobriety is in my relationships. Sobriety is in my job. Sobriety is in my schoolwork. Sobriety is in my family. And sobriety is going to meetings. And I have to say that, too, because this program has given me such a full life that I complain about, like, every other day because it's busy and it's hard. And it's stressful, and that full life can take away from my AA life so easily. And I have to remember where it came from. You know, the girl that couldn't make it to class for a year and a half. Last year I graduated with my undergrad, and I'm in grad school right now for, you know, the next 2 years. And some days that feels like a jail sentence. Some days I have to remember to sit back and recognize the blessings in my life, because sometimes I just want to not be grateful. And AA lets me, and my sponsor lets me see, like, where I can improve and the areas of my life where, you know, if I feel like, and I always say this, like, if I feel like I've made it, I've got so much further to go. If I feel like I've gotten there, then I'm not even close to getting started. You know, I have to realize on a daily basis that there's always room for growth. There's always room for learning in this program. And I think that that's what makes it so great. You know, I always feel like when I get up here, like, I'm not good enough. I'm not sober enough. I don't do enough. I don't, you know, I'm not what AA looks like, you know. But the fact of the matter is I was a hopeless alcoholic. I couldn't be awake without having alcohol in me. And the fact of the matter is I woke up this morning and I called my mom. And I wished her a happy Mother's Day, and I told her, I'll see you tomorrow. I'm going to take you out to lunch. I went to my home group this morning. I keep my commitments today. I went to work on time, sober. You know, these are all things that I wouldn't have if it weren't for this program, and I take them for granted on a daily basis, and sometimes it just takes sitting back and saying these are the blessings in your life. I am grateful to be here today, and I am going to end early because when you're done, you're done. So thank you, Billy.